Words are powerful. They cause fear, confusion, and anger, or they can create shared understanding. But when words are delivered by a powerful political leader, their impact can inspire us to great action. And it is to those words that we turn now, in the power of words.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath.
Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Welcome to The Power of Words, a year-long series of programs tracing American history through some of the most inspirational political speeches of our time. Our series continues today with President John F. Kennedy's speech in West Berlin, delivered on June 26, 1963, during the heart of the Cold War. Joining us today is an old friend, United Nations and foreign policy specialist, author, and political commentator, Stephen Schlesinger. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
Steve, it's great to have you back. You helped us with the JFK inaugural speech, and now you're going to help us understand perhaps one of the most important foreign policy speeches of any president, and that is JFK in West Berlin. But first, before we begin with that, you've got to sort of set the time period for us and what was going on.
Well, Berlin had been a hot spot for American presidents ever since the end of the Second World War. You may recall that when the peace settlement occurred in Europe after the war ended, Germany was divided into four sectors: the French, the British, the American, and the Soviets. And that paradigm was also the way Berlin itself was divided into four sectors. And a couple years after the war ended, the three democratic countries, France, Great Britain, and the United States, allowed their three sectors to come together as a city, and that became West Berlin. And the remaining East Berlin was still controlled by the Soviets. And in a sense, the city became frozen in a division, because by then, the communist powers in East Berlin and in Germany, dominated by the Soviet Union, refused entry into their part of the country and their part of the city. And on the western side, there was West Germany and this isolated island of Berlin, which was right in the midst of the East German sector. And so that was the political situation that faced American presidents from then on. And Harry Truman was the first who had to deal with that, because the Soviets tried to blockade Americans from going into their sector of West Berlin. And that became the famous Berlin blockade, which Truman circumvented by sending in American planes to provide food and other supplies to the Berliners on a daily basis. And eventually, that blockade was defeated, and Stalin withdrew it, in a sense, surrendering to what Truman had done. So then comes August 1961, and the East Germans realize that a lot of their citizens are fleeing the country because of the miserable conditions, the repression, the economic catastrophe that East Germany had become. They're fleeing into West Berlin for freedom. And so what do the East Germans do? They erect a wall, and it becomes the famous Berlin Wall in 1961. So when Kennedy goes to Berlin in 1963, he's faced with this travesty, this grotesque monument to communist defeat, which is the Berlin Wall. And he feels that this is a moment of great importance for him to make clear to the Berliners that he's on their side, and that he will, as Truman did, as Eisenhower did, defend them against any onslaught by the communist powers. But the irony here is that just a year before he went to Berlin, there had been the Cuban Missile Crisis, which Kennedy very cleverly outmaneuvered Nikita Khrushchev and forced him to take his hydrogen or atomic missiles out of Cuba, and in a sense brought the Soviet Union down into one of their great defeats. yet at the same time, rather than humiliate Khrushchev over what had happened at Cuba, Kennedy reached out to him and tried to start negotiations with him to stop the arms race. And 2 weeks before he went to Berlin in 1963, he gave a famous speech at American University in which he made an open plea to Khrushchev, let us try to come to an agreement on at least limiting the tests of atomic and hydrogen bombs in the atmosphere and underground. And this was one of the first times that an American president during the frozen era of the Cold War had broken with precedent and actually reached out to the enemy, in this case, the Soviets, and asked for their forbearance and willingness to negotiate and come to an agreement to stop at least part of the arms race. So he comes into Berlin having made this quite extraordinary address at American University in which he seeks to reach an agreement with the Soviets, at least on a limited basis, to slow down this terrible arms race that has created huge caches of weaponry on both sides.
And I think, Stephen Schlesinger, I think we have to remind people that at the time, you know, we were coming from a time when school children, I'm sure you remember it, had to duck under cover and duck under their desks thinking that that was going to protect them from an A-bomb.
This had been absolutely the mindset that I grew up with in the 1950s. You're absolutely right about that. And there was this almost, I think the word is, ideological passion against communism that we all shared. It was a fear that the devil himself was going to infiltrate and destroy our country. And of course, you don't deal with the devil. You don't even recognize the devil. You do everything you can to banish the devil from your premises. And that was the feeling that people had, particularly in the 1950s, which made it even more difficult for Kennedy to break that mindset and say, listen, we can talk to these Soviets. We can come to an agreement. They are, after all, human beings. They, after all, live under the threat of nuclear war. And there has to be some reasonable solutions we can come to. And that was really what American University address was all about. We are all in this world together. We all live on a small planet. We must address issues of common apprehension and fear together, or otherwise we're going to end up, as we almost did under the Cuban Missile Crisis, facing a nuclear holocaust. Anyway, he does that speech. He then, 2 weeks later, goes to Berlin. Now, the Berlin speech was one that had already been written for him. But as he drove into Berlin and he talked to the various dignitaries there, and including the American general, sort of representing our troops that were in place in Germany, he gave them a chance to look at the speech. And all of them said, you know, this is not a very good speech. You're not going to really address the issues and emotions that were on the minds of Berliners at that time. And so he throws away the first part of the speech and talks extemporaneously. And that is the way he integrates the famous phrase, Ich bin ein Berliner, in which he says, I am a Berliner. The phrase that caught the imagination of not only that city, but of people around the world when he expressed that he was defending freedom, but he was thinking of it in terms of the way it was being defended here in Berlin.
But Stephen, what was he really saying when he used those words?
He was really saying that the American government and the American people were behind Berlin.
Were standing in the crowd, yeah. They were them.
That's right. Yeah. There was a crowd of 150,000 people. Yeah. I mean, it was an extraordinary turnout. And the point I'm making is that as he started emotionally talking to these people, almost, you know, person to person, and started out with that phrase, Ich bin ein Berliner. And by the way, as you may know, he misused that phrase. He should have said, Ich bin Berliner. But by using the phrase, Ich bin ein Berliner, later people said, well, when you say ein Berliner, you're talking about a famous Berlin pastry. And he wasn't obviously saying, I am a pastry. But that was the phrase that unfortunately had been given to him as the way to address this crowd. But they didn't care. They were just happy he was there, and they knew what he was trying to say. But I'm on your side. We're with you. We're not going to leave you to the fate of the communist empire. We're going to be with you forever. But from then on, his emotions carried him away. And at one point he says, there are many people in the world who really don't understand or say they don't. What is the great issue between the free world and the communist world? Let them come to Berlin. There are some who say that communism is the wave of the future. Let them come to Berlin. And there are some who say in Europe and elsewhere, we can work with the communists. Let them come to Berlin. Well, That last sentence, where he suggests we can't work with the communists, was a kind of repudiation of his speech 2 weeks earlier at American University, where he said we can work with them. And I think in retrospect, that was the one sentence that kind of marred his speech in Berlin, because it seemed to reject exactly what he had been talking about at the American University address.
On the other hand, he was talking to two different constituencies in a way, was he not?
True. And clearly, I think people understood that he was not repudiating American University. But it does show that, in a sense, even a man of great discipline could be carried away emotionally by the spirit of the occasion and the fact that this crowd of 150,000 who turned out to see him were emotionally with him and needed that extra sense of an American president saying, we're going to defend you at any cost.
Huh. Do you think, Stephen Schlesinger, that, I mean, we know what the evolution of communism was, but when you look back on this as a sort of timeline, was this speech the beginning of the end for communism?
Well, it certainly was the first crack in the communist facade, in the sense that, combined with the American University speech 2 weeks earlier, the Berlin speech in which Kennedy made clear that he was not going to surrender this piece of land in West Berlin to the communists under any kind of pressure, may have convinced the Russians at that time that it was time to think seriously about negotiating some sort of arms agreement with the American government. And it is true that shortly after those two speeches occurred, the negotiations did begin for a limited test ban treaty. And by September of that year, that agreement was before the Senate for ratification, and it was ratified. And so we had the first break in a long Cold War that showed that we could talk to the communists, we could work with them, in a sense, and try to sort out the ideological differences and put aside the issues that might address and spiral out and into war. And so, yes, I think in many ways, these two speeches, as well as the willingness of Kennedy to break with the past and show a flexibility about how you deal with your foes, all together showed that communism might be brought to a halt and that things could change and maybe the world may eventually evolve in a direction that would leave the communist empire collapsing. And of course, that's what eventually did happen.
You know, Stalin was certainly, from everything we know about him, not only paranoid, but sort of rabid. He would kill purges, all of the rest of the stuff. Tell us a little bit, Stephen, if you would, about who was on the other side, on the Russian side at the time, and whether or not they were more willing, because Stalin was now gone. If you read Khrushchev's memoirs, you know how scared they were. They were scared to death of Stalin, and they thought he twitched at the very end, his toe twitched, and they all almost had heart attacks. But Khrushchev is portrayed by himself, by the way, as a much more amenable person. He did come to the United Nations, and he did bang on the table with his shoe and all the rest of it. But this was a different crowd, wasn't it?
Well, it was a different crowd. And Khrushchev gave the famous speech in 1956 where he openly repudiated Stalin and Stalinism. And that speech enabled changes to start happening in Russia. And there was, for the first time, a less repressive atmosphere facing Soviet citizens. But Khrushchev was also a great believer in Soviet dominance. Remember, he at one point said, "We will crush you." And he was saying that directly to Americans. And he was also the man who sent Russian troops to crush the Hungarian Revolution of 1956. So on the one hand, he was rather more open personality. He was more ebullient. He almost struck you as a kind of corn porn figure who expressed his thoughts without censor and didn't really give a damn about who he offended. So he, in that sense, there was a more open spirit. Stalin was so totally closed down, almost a frozen figure. Yet at the same time, Khrushchev was a believer in communism and really thought that that ideology would eventually take over the world. And he was the man in the end who did send the missiles to Cuba. So there were almost two aspects to the Khrushchev personality. And I think Kennedy sensed that. I think he, at the same time that he was totally offended and absolutely outraged by the fact that Khrushchev would secretly place intercontinental missiles in Cuba in 1962. Yet at the same time, the two of them were negotiating a resolution to that crisis. And in the notes that were sent back and forth, they were two men who realized that a nuclear holocaust could destroy both countries, that they were both possible victims of any kind of war of that sort. And he then realized that Khrushchev was a person he could deal with. And that, I think, was the genesis of the American University speech, of the eventual treaty that came out for a limited test ban treaty. And as we know, the more open Soviet society became, the more cultural exchanges that went on, the more treaties that were made in ensuing years between other presidents and the Russians, that gradually created a more liberal atmosphere in Russian society, and it produced a new leader named Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the final figure in the collapse of the Soviet Empire. So I think all of that comes out of that Kennedy era, comes out of the Berlin speech as well as the inaugural speech that Kennedy gave, all in an attempt to reach out and start talks with our enemies.
On the other hand, unlike Stalin, Khrushchev had a sort of military-industrial complex, if you will, behind him. The old troglodytes, the guys who used to come out there with the hats and the coats on Kremlin Day. And he had to worry about them getting him, which eventually they did. That being a big difference. Don't you think, Stephen Schlesinger, that in some ways these guys, Kennedy and Khrushchev, had to help each other with their military and with the people who were looking over their shoulders?
No question about it. You know, if you read the messages that were sent back between Kennedy and Khrushchev during the Cuban Missile Crisis, they both are talking about the pressures they were feeling from their own military to attack. And I think that Khrushchev had the, in a sense, the greater burden, because he's the one who impulsively had sent those missiles into Cuba, and now he had to justify taking them out, and he had to do it against intense pressures by his own military, who were going to be deeply embarrassed, if not totally messed up, by having to surrender to the great enemy, the United States.
But on the other hand, I'm sorry, you go with the other hand. Go ahead.
Yeah, on the other hand, as you read the Kennedy records, he had Curtis LeMay, who was head of the American Air Force, ready to, send over the bombers and obliterate the Soviet Union.
And China, by the way, before that.
China, too.
Yeah. But I am very interested in this because, on the other hand, it seems to me that Khrushchev, when you say impulsively put those missiles into Cuba, it may well have been less than impulsive and more to satisfy that very old guard.
It could have been both. There's no question. But my sense is that the way that was done suggests more that Khrushchev thought he was going to pull a sort of brilliant trick on the Americans. After all, he always made the arguments that the Americans were encircling the Soviet Union. We had missiles in Turkey. We had troops and missiles all through Western Europe. And that was much closer to the Soviet Union than anything the Soviet Union had as encircling America. And so it was, from his point of view, a rather brilliant stroke to emplace missiles just 90 miles off the shores of the United States.
Sure, that's something Americans were hardly aware of. You know, at the time, here's a bad old Khrushchev, but we had these missiles all over around Turkey and everything else. And that was a very scary proposition, obviously, to the Soviets. Not that I have too much pity for them. You know, right after the wall came down, Stephen, I went over to with a group of sort of journalists and academics to inspect the way things were going. And we were taken over onto the east side. And then they asked us one day, where do you want to go now? And we said, we want to go see the 380,000 Soviet troops who were still there, left over from those days, because they had nowhere to put them back in the old Soviet Union or Russia at the time. And we went back, and you never saw anything like it. You know, you had signs of Stalin up there. And we walked into a museum, which was the biggest thing I've ever seen, with Spitfires coming out of recreating the battle for Berlin and all the rest of it. So I think people really have no idea about just how communist the East was. And I have to tell you, it was fascinating to me, because when we went into shops, truly, Americans were not beloved. We were the great Satans when we walked into a shop in East Berlin. These people had been proselytized from day one. And that's the context for the speech.
No question about it. You know, Kennedy saw he didn't use the word, but he saw the wall as an obscenity. And his speech was really directed to making clear that the communist system was a failure. And the failure was evident in the fact that they had to erect a wall to keep citizens from fleeing East Germany and East Berlin. But I also went to Berlin shortly after Kennedy's speech. I was there in late 1963 and remember going through Checkpoint Charlie, which is the checkpoint that allowed you to go from West Berlin to East Berlin. And the difference, it was like going between daylight and nighttime, because when you got into East Berlin, it was deserted streets. There were practically no stores. There were no restaurants. There was very few cars on the streets. Everything looked like the Second World War had just ended. It was a bleak and depressing scene. And I think that Kennedy, in doing this Berlin speech, was trying to emphasize there are differences between the democracies of the West and the communist nations of the East. And I think this speech was all about making clear that he was going to do battle to protect those democracies, whether it be the citizens of East Berlin or the countries of Western Europe or other democracies around the globe, against what was clearly a kind of bestial communist dictatorship that was unable to even deal with the economic issues in its own countries and yet continued to have this incredible array of weaponry, nuclear weaponry, which allowed the Soviet Union to expand around the world willy-nilly.
He was talking, of course, to the West Berliners, and they loved him. But he was also, I'm sure you're saying to us now, was talking to the East Berliners.
He was talking to the East Berliners, and he had to be careful. You know, after the speech ended, he said to some of his aides, you know, if I had told these people right now, you go down and tear down that wall, that crowd of 150,000 people would have done that. He said, I had to be very careful not to be carried away, because there was such strong emotion when he gave that speech that he could sense that literally if he'd given the crowd any instructions, they would have done it. And so he clearly wanted to send the message, which I've just made clear about, which is that he was going to defend Berliners against any onslaught by the communists. But he also had to be careful not to arouse the emotions of East Germans, or at least East Berliners, because he realized that they could themselves be in trouble. They could be shot and killed by their own countrymen if they tried to scale those walls. So he couldn't go too far in this address, but he could certainly make the point that he did, which is, we will defend West Berlin.
Well, there was a younger man who became an older man named Ronald Reagan, and eventually he said to Gorbachev, tear down this wall. This sort of became a regular stopping post for American presidents for a while there, did it?
It did become one. I think if you look at almost all the presidents since JFK, every one of them at some point or another visited Berlin and made the same point that Kennedy made about the obscenity of the Berlin Wall. It was the most symbolic, iconic outpost of communism versus democracy that Western leaders could really emphasize. And it also was the pressure point, too, for where the communists could kind of encircle the city and put pressure on it as a way of diverting Western governments from doing things in other parts of the globe. And from both societies then, Berlin was a kind of symbolic point of contention that could be used for political purposes.
Okay, so you're listening to The Power of Words, a co-production of WAMC and the New York State Archives Partnership Trust. I'm Alan Shartok, and we're here with United Nations and foreign policy specialist, author, and political commentator Stephen Schlesinger. Okay, now that we've provided some context for President John F. Kennedy's speech in West Berlin, it's time to listen.
I am proud to come to this city as the guest of your distinguished mayor, who has symbolized throughout the world the fighting spirit of West Berlin. And I am proud. And I am proud to visit the Federal Republic with your distinguished chancellor, who for so many years has committed Germany to democracy and freedom and progress, and to come here in the company of my fellow American, General Clay, who has been in this city during its great moments of crisis, and will come again if ever needed. Two thousand years ago, 2,000 years ago, the proudest boast was, Civis Romanus Sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner. I appreciate my interpreter translating my German. There are many people in the world who really don't understand, or say they don't, what is the great issue between the free world and the communist world. Let them come to Berlin. There are some who say that communism is the wave of the future. Let them come to Berlin. And there are some who say, in Europe and elsewhere, we can work with the communists. Let them come to Berlin. And there are even a few who say that it's true that communism is an evil system, but it permits us to make economic progress. Lass sie nach Berlin kommen. Let them come to Berlin. Freedom has many difficulties, and democracy is not perfect. But we have never had to put a wall up to keep our people in, to prevent them from leaving us. I want to say, on behalf of my countrymen who live many miles away on the other side of the Atlantic, who are far distant from you, that they take the greatest pride that they have been able to share with you, even from a distance, the story of the last 18 years. I know of no town, no city that has been besieged for 18 years, that still lives with the vitality and the force and the hope and the determination of the city of West Berlin. While the wall is the most obvious and vivid demonstration of the failures of the communist system, for all the world to see, we take no satisfaction in it. For it is, as your mayor has said, an offense not only against history, but an offense against humanity, separating families, dividing husbands and wives and brothers and sisters, and dividing a people who wish to be joined together. What is true of this city is true of Germany. Real, lasting peace in Europe can never be assured as long as one German out of four is denied the elementary right of free men, and that is to make a free choice. In 18 years of peace and good faith, this generation of Germans has earned the right to be free, including the right to unite their families and their nation in lasting peace with goodwill to all people. You live in a defended island of freedom, but your life is part of the Maine. So let me ask you as I close to lift your eyes beyond the dangers of today to the hopes of tomorrow, beyond the freedom merely of this city of Berlin or your country of Germany, to the advance of freedom everywhere, beyond the wall, to the day of peace with justice, beyond yourselves and ourselves, to all mankind. Freedom is indivisible. And when one man is enslaved, all are not free. When all are free, then we can look forward to that day when this city will be joined as one, and this country and this great continent of Europe in a peaceful and hopeful globe. When that day finally comes, as it will, the people of West Berlin can take sober satisfaction in the fact that they were in the front lines for almost two decades. All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
That was President John F. Kennedy's speech in West Berlin, delivered June 26, 1963. I'm Alan Chartok, and you're listening to The Power of Words, a year-long series of programs that follows American history through some of the most memorable and inspiring political speeches of our time. Joining us on the program today is Stephen Schlesinger, United Nations and Foreign Policy Specialist, author, and political commentator. Stephen, as you listen to that one more time, what are you thinking?
Well, I think what impresses me most is the emotion of the occasion. I mean, 150,000 people turning out. This is one of the main times of the Cold War when there's a feeling of anxiety on both sides, the Soviet side and the American side. And this young president comes to Berlin, who's a war hero and a very popular figure around the world. And he wants to persuade the Berliners that he's with them, and he does it in a kind of classic way of let people come to Berlin, he keeps talking about, and he does it in a dramatic fashion, and people there respond to him, and they see this brilliant, handsome, young figure, and they feel this passion about him. And I think all of that comes together with this speech, which talks about the devastation of what communism is all about, and talks to the issue of this terrible wall that splits the wonderful city of Berlin. And all of this gives you a sense that this was a great historic moment and one that will live in our memory. And it has. It has. People remember that as much as they today remember Reagan's speech about Berlin. So I think all of that comes through.
So there is a different constituencies, there's several different constituencies there. One of them was the West Berliners. Another was the East Berliners and the rest of the Soviet bloc. And another was for popular consumption back home. Could you address the three differences?
Well, first of all, I think the popular consumption back home was very important because Kennedy, as you may recall, that during the campaign, one of the reasons that he beat Nixon is he talked about a so-called missile gap that he said had existed between the American government and the Soviet regime. And it turns out there wasn't really a missile gap once he got into power. But he was facing a foe who was full of nuclear armaments and was trying to subvert countries around the globe. And so I think it was very important for him to make clear to the American people that he was upholding the defense of their country. but not in a reckless manner, but simply in a way that would be convincing both to our Western allies and to alert the Soviets that we were going to be the defenders of freedom in that part of the world. So that was the American constituency. And I might say just one other thing. The reason I'm emphasizing this is that he was under attack in his first 3 years in office, his only 3 years in office, from the right-wing Republicans who were always saying he was weak on communism. The Democrats are traditionally, you know, the surrender types who get into Washington. And so it was very important that he emphasized that Democratic presidents could be strong defenders of American values.
Stephen, let me stop you right there, and then we'll go back to this. But I've never understood that. Maybe you, because you have a phenomenal, you know, understanding of American history. But why did Democrats get saddled with that? After all, it was Harry Truman who did Korea. It was JFK who did the Cuban Missile Crisis. And yet it goes on and it persists. What's that about?
It's partly Republicans, you know, were great isolationists for many years. And part of their attack on American, on Democratic presidents was that Democratic presidents get us into war. Wilson got us into the First World War. Franklin Roosevelt got us into the Second World War. John F. Kennedy got us into the Vietnam War. They always feel that somehow if Democratic presidents had been stronger or had they'd been more forceful in the defense of our society, we wouldn't be in war. So it's both saying that somehow the weakness of Democratic presidents embroil us in these huge catastrophes abroad. And if only Republicans had been in, we would never have been in this situation. I think it's partly that, and it's partly the feeling that Democrats come into office wanting to cut the defense budget, and therefore we're weakening us as a country. And of course, Democrats do try to shift resources from purely defense spending to domestic spending. They're trying to help cure poverty and deal with disease and build up the middle class in this country. So that's another point of weakness in terms of where the Republicans think that they can pummel the Democrats.
And yet told us about the military-industrial complex.
No, I think Republicans, once they're in power, realize that they are, in a sense, captive to the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower talked about in his final speech to the American people. But while they're running for office, it's much easier to paint the Democrats as weak and the Republicans as strong. And that's been the traditional way they campaign. And that was true when John McCain contending against Barack Obama. It's almost a constant replay throughout particularly modern day campaigning.
So go back to the other constituencies. You've given us the poop on what's going on with the American people at the time. There are two others. There's the East and there's the West.
We'll talk about the West now. Any time an American president came into power during the Cold War, Western Europe always needed reassurance from the American president that they would be defended. Because the whole point of setting up NATO was that this was a joint enterprise between the U.S. and all the Western democracies, where the U.S. would come to the defense of the Western European nations if the Soviets ever invaded. And, of course, the Western Europeans live right next door to the Soviet Union and to the captive nations of Eastern Europe. And they were under that threat day in and day out. So they needed the reassurance from every new American president who came into power. And one of Kennedy's reasons for going to Europe at that particular time was to do the thing that any political leader in Washington had to do. Yes, we're with you. We're going to defend Western Europe. We're going to defend Berlin. The most symbolic outpost of that period was Berlin. And then that was why when Kennedy went to West Berlin, he made that address in front of a huge crowd to say, we're not going to desert you. We're with you. The American nuclear defense will come to you no matter what kind of crisis you face. And so, yes, that was reassurance that the West Berliners needed. As for East Berlin, we were talking not only, that speech was not only addressed to West Berlin or the American society, but to the captive nations of the Communist Empire. In that case, East Berlin and East Germany. And he was saying, you know, you can throw everything you want against us, but we're not going to put up with it. You can throw up that wall. You can threaten us with all sorts of subversion or weaponry, but we're not going to retreat. We're in this battle till it ends. And if you think you can scare us, you're thinking about a wrong thing, because we're not going to be scared. And therefore, your society could live on in sort of economic devastation as you have to put up this wall to keep people from fleeing. But we're promising you that if you're willing to deal with us, maybe there'll be change in the future. Maybe you can be a freer society. Maybe that we can tear down this wall and make it possible for all of our countries to live in peace. So I think there were all these different messages going through this speech that he gave in Berlin.
Now, we know that in the end, the wall did come down. Communism did collapse. But I'm wondering, I know woulda, coulda, shoulda, but I'm wondering whether you and your conversations with your famous father, Arthur Schlesinger, ever thought about what would have happened if he had lived longer? Would there have been a difference in our relations on the very topics you've been discussing?
I think that there would have been much different policies, for example, in Vietnam. I think Kennedy would have tried to work out a peace settlement with the Vietnamese. He understood that the Vietnamese were nationalists, even though they paraded around as communists, and that there would have been a deal possible without having to send in 500,000 American troops, which happened under Lyndon Johnson. I think Kennedy was a believer that you talk with people, that you negotiate with them, that you don't treat them purely as the devil, that you couldn't ever even discuss common issues of concern with the enemy. And I think, therefore, if Kennedy had lived, while he could give that speech in Berlin, he could also give the speech, as I said, in American University, and he would put up his fist, but he would put out his hand simultaneously. And with that mindset, as president, you can do a lot of things. You can break with the past. You can deal with the foes and come to some sort of agreements that prevent the outbreak of new war. And you can save American lives in doing so. And I think, unfortunately, Lyndon Johnson was so freaked out by the communist boogeyman that he couldn't overcome that Cold War mentality, which Kennedy was able to overcome. And that was the difference, really, between Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy when it came to foreign policy.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it because it was where I wanted to go next, and that is to Lyndon Johnson. Clearly, Kennedy thought he had to have Johnson on the ticket. He did take Texas. As you said in an earlier interview with me, that it was Texas that won it for JFK, and it was crucial, and Johnson delivered it. But Johnson and Kennedy were not the same man. And what was that tension like?
Almost from the beginning, Johnson and Kennedy disliked each other. Johnson tried to get the presidential nomination in 1960, and Kennedy defeated him. And it was only over the objections of John Kennedy's brother, Robert Kennedy, that he finally selected Lyndon Johnson as his vice president. And there were always tensions in the White House between the two. Johnson had been used to wielding power as the majority leader of the U.S. Senate, and suddenly he was relegated to being a kind of weak vice president. Well, not weak, but at least a vice president who was not in the headlines anymore. And so the tension between the two continued through their first 3 years of the 1960s during the Kennedy time in office. And as a result of the assassination, when Johnson took over, all the anger and differences that existed between the two men erupted. And it came out symbolically in the estrangement that Robert Kennedy had while he was still Attorney General with Lyndon Johnson, which led eventually to Bobby Kennedy resigning and running for the Senate in New York and eventually challenging Johnson in 1968 for the presidency. So it was a marriage of convenience between John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Both entered into that marriage for their own reasons. Kennedy because he wanted to win the election, Johnson because he figured this was the only chance he might have to become president ultimately. And it worked because JFK had all the authority and could control Lyndon Johnson. But once he died, that was the end in terms of harmony. And the warfare then broke out in the Democratic Party between the Bobby Kennedy wing and the Lyndon Johnson wing.
Back to the time, you could love JFK. It was very hard. You could admire Johnson, but it was very hard to love the man.
He was not a lovable man. He didn't really have much of a sense of humor. There was something lugubrious about his speeches. There was a heaviness about him, a man who was kind of stuck in an ancient period of American history. He didn't really seem to relate to what were all the new things that John F. Kennedy had talked about and done while in office. And yet, it's funny because Lyndon Johnson was the man who created Medicare, who brought about civil rights legislation, made major changes in the way we operate our country, and yet he's remembered for the Vietnam disaster.
I want to ask you about another president, and that's Barack Obama. Is it possible to go back to the speech, to the Kennedy speech in East Berlin, declaring that he's a Berliner, and see any intellectual debt that Obama owes to him?
Well, there's a famous quote in the JFK speech in Berlin, which does relate to our day today, although he may not have meant it squarely in that sense when he gave that utterance back in 1963. He says, "Freedom is indivisible, and when one man is enslaved, all are not free. When all are free, then we can look forward to the day when this city will be joined as one, and in this country, in this great continent of Europe, in a peaceful and hopeful globe." Well, he was talking about the time period of 1963, and yet he, in a sense, he was talking about the enslavement we have had in our own country and the way we treated Black Americans for the first part of the century of our history and the way we treat them during the period after the Civil War, and finally the breakthrough of the civil rights movements of the 1960s that eventually ended the stigma of enslavement in all its different variables. And that produced, you know, only about 30 or 40 years later, our first Black American president, Barack Obama.
But from a foreign policy perspective, did Obama owe anything to JFK?
Well, certainly he did, in the sense that JFK came into office saying, we have to be a multilateral country. We have to start dealing with our foes. We can't just close ourselves off from people we differ with. And he talks about that in his inaugural address, and he talks about it again in his Berlin address. And yes, this is exactly what Barack Obama did when he came into office. He wanted to break with the status quo of the almost indifference that George W. Bush showed towards the rest of the world, a kind of feeling of that Washington should represent a unilateralism that would be the way we could conduct foreign policy. That was what Barack Obama conducted his campaign against. He wanted to switch away from what he thought was a very destructive policy under George W. Bush and bring us back to the great international tradition of both the Democratic Party and our country as a whole, and readdress our foes in Iran and North Korea and other hotspots around the globe. And he has done that. I mean, he's certainly re-embraced the United Nations in a way that George W. Bush never did. And he started to do that with countries like Iran. It's not been a successful policy so far, but it's a showing of willingness on his part to break out of the stasis of the past and show a new face of American life to the world at large. And as a result, Barack Obama is probably the most popular politician today around the planet.
At least around the world, if not in the United States.
Well, he is slipping a little right now.
Okay, but there was that metaphor which you've used, Stephen Schlesinger, before in this program, and that is the open, if you make a fist, we'll fight you. If it's an open hand, we'll meet you. That was in the inaugural. It was also part of what I think the American University speech was about, and I think there may be a debt there.
Yes, and I think that clearly Barack Obama is probably the most person who resembles most, who's come into office as president, resembles most John F. Kennedy. He's young, he's new, he's vigorous, he talks in an articulate fashion, he believes in the kind of values that JFK represented, a new willingness to embrace the world, wants to work with the United Nations, believes that other people's viewpoints should be considered. All of those are features that John F. Kennedy represented and tried to represent both in his inaugural address and his Berlin address. And those are the kind of values that we associate with Barack Obama. And he must, in his own look back on American history, have drawn a lot of those lessons from the JFK era. He resembles him so much that I would have thought that it would have been second nature for him to say, we're going to try to do what Kennedy did in the early 1960s in the final period of the first part of the 21st century.
So as the son of a guy who was very close to a lot of presidents, Arthur Schlesinger, I wonder how much when you read these speeches, when you read these inaugurals, you read the Berlin speech, how much do the speechwriters depend on themes from previous presidents?
I think these speeches are part of a tradition of modern American government in its approach to international affairs. You remember that up until about time of Woodrow Wilson, America was basically an isolationist country. We did not get involved in European affairs. We avoided wars in Asia. We focused mainly on Latin America, our own continent. It wasn't really until the Woodrow Wilson era when we began to reassociate American life with foreign countries. And we went into the First World War to defend Western democracies from the German onslaught. And that was when Woodrow Wilson proposed a League of Nations for the first time, a league which we in the end did not join. But it was the first effort to break away from the notion that the U.S. should be a country unto itself and not deal with anybody else. And ever since then, you can see varying policies, both by Republican and Democratic presidents, to deal with the world as it is and the role of American life, American society within that context, within that much larger planetary situation. And I think that the themes that Kennedy brings into the Berlin speech are very much a part of that new tradition that started in the Wilson era. We have to be part of the world. We have to deal with countries that we don't like. We have to live in peace. We have to deal with the arms race. We have to try to bring about freedom, but in a way that is done peacefully and not in a warlike way. All of those themes crop up in his speech, in his address to the residents of Berlin.
But I'm thinking specifically of something you have mentioned in the past, and that is Ronald Reagan gets up there and he says, "Tear down that wall, Gorbachev." And, you know, he knew it resonated for Kennedy. He had to know it was going to be a sure winner for him.
Well, Kennedy, in his speech in Berlin, elevated Berlin to the great symbol of the Cold War, the great showdown between communism and democracy. And ever since then, you're right, American presidents have played off that imagery and identified themselves with the fate of Berlin. And so when Reagan did that speech, he was, in a sense, using those currents of modern American history to emphasize his own role in defeating communism. And of course, he had the great luck, or maybe it was skill, to see that wall fall shortly after he gave that speech. So he, more than any of them, becomes identified with Berlin.
Now, when you compare the Kennedy inaugural, which you have done for this station and done well, with this speech, were they different?
Well, there's actually some similarities, because you remember in the inaugural speech, he uses the phrase, "Let us do this, let us do that." In the Berlin speech, he uses that phraseology in a slightly different way. He says, "Let them come to Berlin," those people who doubt freedom and the need for democracy. "Let them come to Berlin," he keeps saying. So that stylistically, there's some echoes of what he did in the inaugural. But also there are his basic belief that we have to work to bring about peace with our foes. And he talks about, I'm just going to quote a little here from the speech itself. "As I close," he says, "to the hopes of tomorrow, beyond the freedom merely of the city of Berlin or your country of Germany, to the advance of freedom everywhere, beyond the wall, to the day of peace with justice, beyond yourselves and ourselves, to all mankind." Yes, that's very much an echo of what he was talking about in the inaugural address. And so he was very smart in many ways in the way he repeated themes that grew out of his first speech to the American people, the inauguration, in making clear that these were very close to his heart, what he truly believed as president of the United States, the new directions that the country should take. And so they were very much a part of the way he addressed all of these foreign issues, particularly in Berlin.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank our wonderful expert today, Stephen Schlesinger, United Nations and foreign policy specialist, author and political commentator. Stephen Schlesinger, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks also to our producer, David Gustina, the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library, for providing the speech. And a special thanks to Bob Bullock from the New York State Archives Partnership Trust. Be sure to join us next time for another discussion about a great political speech on the power of words.